and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
That's right. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning, iPod users. That's right. I'm reaching out to the iPod users because now in some areas of this country, there's no other way to listen to our show other than podcasting. So I have got to get on board with that, Mark Riley.
Hey, and if you live in New York, be careful because iPod headphones are a big target for thieves.
Yeah.
They are snatching iPods off people's ears.
And oddly, it's not hard to find them.
No.
That's right. Let's get on the train and steal some iPods. Well, where do we find them? Hey, there's an idiot now with white headphones. Let's just go over there and reach into their bag. Yeah. Apparently, they're just pulling them out of bags, so secure your pods, people.
Yeah.
You know,
hold them.
Yeah, exactly. And apparently, it's not a resale market, according to this report, that they're not selling the things. They're just upgrading their own technology.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting that with computer technology, all you got to do is erase your memory, and there you go. You're all set. Unless you like the guy's music. You know, you might steal an iPod and go, oh, my God, this guy is exactly the same taste as me. I'm going to leave half of these in here. I'm going to get rid of the pictures of his wife, but I'm going to leave these songs in here. And same with the phones, apparently. I didn't realize that. I mean, well, of course I realized that. You can just take the card out of a phone and
reprogram it,
I guess.
Yeah, you can take the SIM card out, put a new SIM card, it's a new phone.
Yeah, my cell phone runs on gas, so you know, I've got one of the older models.
So yours must cost about, what, $5 a gallon by now?
It's very expensive to run now, you know, with the plan I have as well. I don't update anything. I'm still far away from getting an iPod, but I will say that we've gotten a lot of email from people. And people, you can podcast on other those downloadable music things. I hear the iRiver is good. But in L.A., we're going to be gone if we're not gone already. I'm not sure when that goes into place. I think it's next week. We're going to miss you. San Francisco, we've been pushed back. Or are we gone altogether? I can't remember, but I know they dropped Springer in there. So we're pushed back to 3 to 6 in San Francisco. And, you know, we appreciate all the literally hundreds of emails in anger of Clear Channel's decision to bump us back. But, you know, there's nothing we can do from this end. And I just wanted to say that you can podcast. You can you can go to morningsedition.com and find out where you can listen to our show. Since now it's become sort of a special club, a special event for some people. I'm telling you, Riley, the lengths that people are going to listen to Morning Sedition on the West Coast is hilarious because a lot of people, not hilarious, it's sad, but a lot of people used to listen to KPOJ,
yeah.
And they bumped us out for local programming. All right, I believe we're on the middle of the night there, too. So now San Francisco did as well, but a lot of people that woke up on the East Coast,
yeah,
and didn't want to get up at 6 in the morning were listening to the KPOJ feed, the stream, you know, at 9 o'clock our time.
Here, oh, I see. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So they could listen to it. And now the people on the West Coast are having a hard time figuring out. But I think Sacramento has still got us up and going at the proper time in the morning because we are a morning show. So if you want to stream from Sacramento, you can go to morningsedition.com and that'll link you to that. I'm just trying to help out our listeners. And Seattle as well. We're on in real time. My father-in-law listens in Seattle. I got a little feedback. He called my wife.
Uh-oh.
And said, yeah, it's great hearing Mark in real time. Now I know what you ate last night, where you went last night, that you made enchiladas. And then he said, but tell them to lay off the Catholic Church a little bit. They do some good stuff. He said, lay off the Catholics, old John. He said, lay off the Catholics because they're the ones feeding the people downtown at the mission. They're the ones having the AA meetings in the basement. And he said that most Catholics are actually a little more progressive than other Christians. And a lot of Catholics actually vote Democratic.
Well, there's been a very long history of Catholics voting Democratic, particularly in northern urban areas. That's changed over time to some small extent, but ethnic Catholics have traditionally voted Democratic.
Yeah, I guess we were criticizing the Pope primarily because he used to be a Nazi. Not that that should bother anybody.
He was conscripted.
He was just a Nazi. Conscripted or not, I don't want that to bother anybody. But I don't know how people can dismiss that so easily. Hey, come on, he had to. Yeah, but he was a Nazi. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I mean there are other choices. The guy was a Nazi.
Emigrate, maybe, I don't know.
But it's just hilarious to me that, you know, at one time this guy probably sat in a meeting where they had the Fuhrer, maybe at the Coliseum, and they're like, "Yay, we're going to go see the Fuhrer today." And the Fuhrer said, you are the future of the world. Someday it will all be yours. And now certainly the Catholic realm is one of that. It's now part of that vision, Mark Riley.
Well, you know, his father, in fairness, was opposed to Hitler, supposedly, moved to Bavaria
He's a Nazi.
Well, again, what's interesting about that is, why go to Bavaria? I thought Hitler had, like, a big bunker or something in Bavaria.
Oh, then I know why, Mark. Because he was a Nazi.
Oh, that's what it was. Okay, all right.
But, you know, man, what are we going to do? He's also was in charge of the office. We don't need, you know, this is not old news, but I will say thank you to progressive Catholics that are out there doing the work of charity and empathy and reaching out to the communities, because I have been accused of being anti-Christian and too hard on Christians before, and certainly that is not my intent. It's delusional fanatics I'm against, and I know that a lot of great progressive charities, a lot of great reach-out work comes from the Catholic community and some elements of the Christian community, and if they do follow the teachings of Christ, they are doing the right thing by them, but the people that exploit that. It's interesting how quickly these people get used. Like even the Justice Sunday thing last Sunday, that you have all these minions of all these power-hungry Christian fanatical leaders, and now that the Republicans are changing their spin, I haven't heard nothing in four days about that. That thing went out to, 1,000 churches nationwide, and now, you know, it's like the hush-hush is on because they're changing their language. They're like, you know, the judicial war on faith is didn't work. So now it's a constitutional war. They're changing their framing, so now they're hanging out to dry, the thousands and thousands and thousands of people that got all worked up by that broadcast, but they don't care. They can turn them on and off. It's like the Manchurian Candidate thing.
The politicians can retract from overreaching, and we're seeing quite a bit of that going on, which we're going to get into later on this morning, but it's much more difficult for these foot soldiers in the far right army to go back on what they, you know, I mean, these people just a week ago were talking about the Supreme Court like they were the moral equivalent of the Klan.
Yeah.
It's difficult to go to back. Well, gee, I'm sorry. I didn't really mean to say that.
But you know what's hilarious is that the people that said that are the true legacy of the Klan.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's amazing. Tony Perkins, just 4 years ago, was meeting with that Council of Concerned Citizens, which, of course, was the grandchild of the White Citizens Council that ravaged the South, the ones that Trent Lott, the same group that Trent Lott met with, that ended up costing him his gig in the Senate.
Yeah.
So, you know, Tony Perkins making common cause with these folks. People, what you need to understand is these folks don't care who they make common cause with. They really don't. You got a black guy standing up on the stage with Tony Perkins acting like they're buds.
Yeah, but he's been bought.
Yeah, he's been bought. But what happens when Perkins whips out the noose? What? You know what I'm saying? These guys really believe in their heart of hearts that they have something in common with these. These people don't give a crap about them.
Yes.
Not one bit.
Uh-huh.
But they'll make common cause for the short term, but watch what happens when the politicians start jumping ship and the dollars dry up.
It's interesting, too, Riley. It seems that there's been a cabinet chosen in Iraq. And, you know, yesterday, we have a lot of stuff coming out of Iraq this week. Tomorrow, actually, you can look forward to this. We're going to be talking to our friend Mick Ware, Time Magazine's Baghdad bureau chief, and one of our favorite guests. It's rare that he's actually stateside. He's going to come in and lay it out for us. But we're going to talk a little bit. They've chosen a cabinet.
Yeah.
There now is more talk about the possibility of civil war, even with the new cabinet. We have a military spokesman saying things about Iraq in relation to Iraq a year ago. Very, disturbing revelations. We're also going to talk about how the Republicans are in a bit of a freak out. It's tremendous that the Democrats are actually, you know, having some effect, you know, in the houses of the Senate and the Congress. It's very exciting to see them start to fidget, the Republicans. I'm very excited about that, about the result of what happened with the ethics rule. And also we're going to talk about the possibility of a third party in the Internet and the Congressional Black Caucus. Not everybody's happy on the Democratic side. We got a pretty big show. And at the end of it all, the big payoff is Phil Lesh, the bass player for the Grateful Dead. That may not mean something to a lot of you, but for me, the Grateful Dead, you know, at a point in my life, which I'm already apologizing for. Yeah, how come I have to apologize for my? I lived with Deadheads. I've been to only four shows, so that makes me very light. I don't have a Grateful Dead problem.
Okay.
Sure. I'm positive, but I love the Grateful Dead. They were one of the great rock bands, and this guy is one of the survivors, not only of the Grateful Dead, but of a complete generation that kind of blew music apart. I'm very very excited
to
talk to
him. Is Frank up yet? Does he know we got Phil Lesh on today? Because he's going to call him.
Maybe he'll call in. Hey, Phil. By that time you guys were playing in Syracuse, I remember I took some mushrooms with Chevy Chase.
Oh.
Anyways, I'm still a little too nasally on that one. 16 past the hour. Good morning. It's Thursday. We'll be back with all those stories and more. Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Reverend, go to Jess.com for a limited time and you can subscribe for only $9.95 a year. Enter code Air America. Subscribe now. That's JEST.com. Celebrity voices may not be real.
Hey, 20 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's morning's edition on Air America Radio. Thursday morning, I'm finally feeling better mentally.
You're ramping down to the weekend.
Is that what it is? I still don't quite understand how it all works, but I know that yesterday I was filled with the gloom. I had the gloom upon me, Riley. You know, they've created a cabinet. There is a cabinet in Iraq. It happened. They just announced it literally a half an hour ago.
Yeah.
Yesterday it hadn't been announced and there was trouble. A minister was assassinated, I believe.
An assembly member, a female member of the Iraqi National Assembly, who, by the way, had been apparently the target of a couple of assassination attempts before. So there's both good news and bad news coming out of Iraq. The good news, as you point out, Mark, is that they do now have at least the outlines of a cabinet. 32 members, 27 ministers, 5 acting ministers. I don't know, you know, how much people ought to be celebrating the fact that, for example, Ahmad Chalabi, the former Pentagon favorite, turned alleged Iranian, should I call him an alleged Iranian spy?
I think, you know, it seems to me in retrospect, Riley, that, you know, a lot of that stuff that guy went through was to teach him a lesson, because he's obviously a very powerful political operative in the region. He's obviously okayed on some level by our administration.
Yeah.
And it seems that they were just trying to screw around with that guy. Well, you know, he's obviously a dirty guy, but so are the guys that run our country.
Well, yeah. And, you know, you had here 180 lawmakers out of 185 present for this for the meeting to ratify the cabinet. That's out of 275 total parliament members. Of course, Al Jafari, who is the Shiite Prime Minister designate, Ibrahim al-Jafari, is going to be the acting defense minister. Now, Chalabi will be one of the 4 deputy prime ministers and the acting oil minister.
See that?
That should make people very, very nervous about who is actually going to end up controlling Iraq's apparently only natural resource.
But, you know, it's disturbing, but again, I'm saying that all the stuff that guy went through, the accused Iranian spying, the shaking him down, you know, the military, you know, tearing up his house, holding him against his will for a period of time, I think it was a reprimand. I think that he had overstepped and that, you know, in order to get him back in line with their agenda, the neocons, you know, wanted to shake him up. I think he's completely an American pawn, has been since day one, and anything else, if you think anything else, it's crazy.
Well, yeah. And, you know, at a point, the government is going to have to do something about situations like what happened to Lamia Abed Kaduri Sakri, who was the Iraqi assembly member who answered a knock at her door and was assassinated. Now, she's the first assembly member to be assassinated. I don't know whether that's, you know, important, given the fact that they've just elected the assembly in January, for God's sake. But she was, I guess, considered pretty much a soft target. She was someone that they had been after before. They accused her, of course, of being a collaborator. She's a Shiite, but they accused her of being a collaborator with the U.S.-backed government. And this successful assassination could lead to other attempts on the lives of other National Assembly members.
Well, they have tried to kill them before. There have been people within the political structure that have been assassinated, and we're getting reports that in the cultural arena of Iraq, the words civil war are not taboo anymore, that there is a possibility, even once the government is established, that there will be factions within the government that might have their own militias. Tell me about when they say, Riley, the Lebanonization
of Iraq. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, the Lebanonization of Iraq would be generally talking about what happened in Lebanon, which was a civil war that was ended when Syria actually sent troops into the country. Now, Syria was successful in ending the Lebanese civil war, but bottom line, you know, the Lebanese came to deeply resent the Syrian presence in their country, which is only just now ending, and the civil war in Lebanon started in 1976.
So when they talk about it in relation to Iraq, I imagine they're not referring to the mess that we made there and what they're reacting to. What they're talking about is now that a Shia majority is going to rule over the Sunni minority, basically.
Yeah.
And the Sunni was in charge before, and with the Kurds wanting an autonomous zone, that what you're going to have is several different zones that maybe have their own leaders, and if there are, you know, problems, you know, between the zones, that there's going to be ongoing conflict on top of an active insurgency that doesn't seem to have relented.
Well, yeah, and the other thing that you have here, Mark, is an attempt, and this is also, I think, a little bit similar to Lebanon, to appoint a government that somehow represents all these different factions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, bottom line, even though there may be, you know, people may be focusing on the Shiite situation, the bottom line is none of this would have happened had America not invaded. The Shia would not be running the country now had not the Americans invaded, for better or for worse, however you want to look at that. But what we're seeing happen now is an attempt to try and put together a diverse cabinet in the hope, and I'm not sure it's a real hope at all, that, for example, the inclusion of Sunnis would end up blunting somehow the insurgency. I don't think Sunni inclusion in this government is going to do much, quite frankly, and this is speculation on my part. Maybe we can talk to Mick Ware about this tomorrow. But I don't think the Sunni inclusion is going to mean an end to the insurgency. I don't think the insurgents necessarily are fighting for inclusion.
It might empower them, I think, was the thrust of the Civil War idea, is that if they have militias that are operating out there in a terrorist fashion, that if you have some of them being represented within the government, that I think it might actually empower them and make it a more legitimate civil war on that level. But we do, as you know from yesterday, some of you, that there's been the whole idea of WMDs in Syria has been debunked. The reason we went to war was now quite validated as a lie. And now there's evidence that shows that the insurgency is just as strong as ever. And that even the military is saying that, well, you know what, I'm going to hold off on what they said. And we'll talk to you about it when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Reilly on Air America Radio.
And being afraid of life and being afraid of death, where the hell does that leave you?
The Mike Molloy Show on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Reilly.
Hi.
On Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I will be coming to Cincinnati, Ohio. I will be at Go Bananas May 6th and 7th. If you're listening to 1530 WCKY, the Revolution of Talk Radio, come check it out. If you're in the area, come check it out. Just if you want, just come on down. You can go to morningsedition.com for ticket info. This is some interesting stuff, Reilly. The insurgency in Iraq is, quote, about where it was a year ago, unquote, according to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Richard Myers, General Richard Myers. That's unbelievable. So what they're saying is, good news, the situation in Iraq is as bad as it was a year ago. Now, that's stability. You see how that works?
Yep.
Huh?
That's exactly what General Richard Myers is saying. And I don't know exactly how people are supposed to react to this. In fact, he apparently took the Pentagon a little bit by surprise, certainly in terms of this particular assessment. Donald Rumsfeld says there are, quote, a lot of moving parts, unquote, in play in Iraq. You know, Rumsfeld has been, I don't know if you've noticed, but he seems to have been really very much on the down low lately, Mark.
Yeah, well, he should be gone.
Yeah, I know he
should
have been
there.
Gone before the election, but he's still around.
So this, yeah, good.
But, I mean, you don't hear a whole heck of a lot out of it.
That's for sure.
And, in fact, Rumsfeld was at this briefing the other day, but Myers was the one that ended up getting all the ink.
Well, he actually said that basically Rumsfeld's whole pitch these days is that, well, we're doing exactly what we said we would be doing. We're training the Iraqi troops.
and we're leaving the responsibility in their hands. Well, you know, that's why you're seeing, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of Iraqi deaths in terms of their national security troops, because I get the feeling that a lot of these guys don't quite know, you know, what they're doing.
Well, see, and here's the problem you got. Remember that when in the immediate aftermath of the Iraq invasion, there was a wholesale purging at the behest of the leaders of the Coalition Provisional Authority at the time. They purged all of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party members from the Iraqi armed forces. Now, this same government, I'm talking about our government now, is saying to the Iraqis, and this is in the form of Donald Rumsfeld, don't get rid of people from the security forces just because they were members of the Ba'ath Party.
Well, look at that. Look at this administration. John Negroponte, you know, Armitage, you know, these guys, you know, they are old, dirty bastards. These are guys that were involved with Iran-Contra. These are guys that have been involved with dirty dealings in the Republican side of the aisle for years.
Yes.
So, you know, they're saying that the dirty cream rises to the top. If they're confident, no matter how evil or how much conscience they lack, or whatever you think, if they're efficient in the game of politics and killing, use them, for God's sakes. Just keep them on a short leash.
Yeah, keep them on a short leash. And you see how quickly the Iraqis reacted to the statements from the American government about hurry up and finish the cabinet thing, right?
Yeah.
Next day, they got themselves a little cabinet.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I don't know about you, but I would not want to be the only Christian in this cabinet. I'll tell you that right now. You're talking about altogether 27 ministers, 5 acting ministers, and the cabinet includes 17 Shia, 8 Kurds, 6 Sunnis, and a Christian.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, again, everybody else has someone to hang out with. Where does the Christian hang his or her hat? And, you know, again, given the targeting of these of many of these folks, and now that they've been named, I hope they got some extra security with them.
Yeah, well, he can always IM his Christian friends. You know,
right. But Dotson can't help him.
Dotson is arguably not a Christian. But let me just say one thing: what this means when General Richard Myers says to reporters that it's about where it was a year ago. Let's just a little time capsule of April in Iraq in 2004. 122 troops were killed in action in Iraq, plus 8 non-combat deaths. That's more than 900 troops were wounded in April of 2004, more than double the previous high set in October 2003. Through April 2004, 729 U.S. troops had died in Iraq since the invasion. 3,864 troops had been wounded. Obviously, those numbers are a lot higher. But this is interesting. Tom Donnelly, a defense and national security expert in the American Enterprise Institute, at the American Enterprise Institute, said in April 2004 that it was unlikely the insurgency would be able to keep up such violence for long, but he expected terrorist-style attacks to continue. Well, there he was right, but he was wrong about them being able to keep up such violence. In terms of terrorism, a report shows that 2004 had a rise in terror attacks, you know, despite, you know, Condoleezza Rice's amazing attempt to stifle this information. Terrorism worldwide is up. See, so we have had a positive impact on Iraq. Its terrorists have learned to outsource their violence to other countries, and that's democracy, folks.
Well, hey, it's some scary, scary.
It's stuff, horrible,
you know. And again, it is a function of American arrogance. We don't even know, and we talked about this yesterday, Mark. We don't know how many Iraqis have been killed in their own country.
Well, again, Mick Ware, tomorrow, folks, this is we're getting excited about tomorrow's show, because when Mick comes in, you know, you can really trust this guy. This guy spends time on the other side of the wire. This guy's got real courage as a reporter, and he's out in it.
Yeah.
And usually the information he has is information no one else has, and he has it because he lives it. So let's turn to our own cabinet, to our own houses, the Senate, the Congress. This is exciting, because the Republicans are freaking out a little bit, I hope. You know, I'm always suspicious when Republicans do anything in mass that, you know, they've got something up their sleeve. The Karl Rove has moved the giant chess piece on his board. That, you know, he's moved his Denny Hastert chess piece back.
So what does that mean, Riley? They have overturned the new ethics rule that DeLay had put in place to protect him. This is good news for the other side, for us.
Yeah, I mean, when you hear Denny Hastert, Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, saying, I am willing to step back.
What is that? That's it. Like, I wish we had that on tape.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about something that most people, even the most optimistic Democrats, didn't think was going to happen until the middle of this year or so. That the Republicans, because they've got a majority in the House, they've got a majority in the Senate, they can push through pretty much whatever they want. Well, in this instance, they rolled back these House rules by a vote of 406-20. It wasn't even close. And a lot of Republicans jump ship on this one. I mean, I don't even know who the 20 who voted against this change actually were. This was, by the way, a draft resolution that restored the rules in place at the start of this year before the Republicans decided to gerrymander them the way DeLay gerrymandered Texas.
Right.
And what it means is that Tom DeLay may be, I guess for the sake of this discussion, out there a little more than he was yesterday at this same time.
Are they hanging him out to dry? Are they going to let him take the shots on his own? Because he seems to be playing it that, well, this is just exactly what I wanted because now it'll give me an opportunity to come clean. They must have some sort of plan. I just hope that he stinks so bad that, you know, he at least loses his seat.
Well, see,
not his seat, but his role.
No, yeah. A majority leader, he may be in jeopardy. Yeah, his leadership. What we see here, Mark, is a very simple thing that a very simple bit of calculus that the Republicans have done. They realize that trying to defend trip taking, whether by Democrats, Republicans, Tories, or Whigs, is a loser with the American people. The American people look at this and say, wait a minute, I can't go and play on St. Andrew's golf course for free. I can't go to Singapore for nothing. I can't go to these different places on someone else's dime.
This coach ride from Maryland to Virginia is going to...
Exactly. And what you see are Democrats and Republicans, both sides of the aisle, going back over their old receipts like they're being audited by the IRS.
Well, it seems that the Republicans, knowing how devious they are and knowing just how much they do know and how meticulous they are and knowing that, you know, Tom DeLay is obviously lying when he says he didn't know who was paying for his trips, they would have gone through the files as best they could of the Democrats. And the numbers they came up with on Pelosi and on a couple others were low and easily explainable. They were not $500,000 paid to one's wife and sister. They were not being flown to Saipan, being flown to Scotland at the behest of a lobbyist. You know, they were low numbers. So it just frightens me a little bit because I know they don't have too much dirt on the Democrats, and I hope that what's happening is they realize that Tom DeLay has become an incredible liability to their party, and he's going to have to fight this out on his own. And, you know, I hope as I said before, I actually do hope he loses his seat, but at least, you know, his leadership position would be nice.
That would be nice. And there are going to be some Democrats who will probably end up being investigated as a result of this rules restoration. I mean, the Republicans are not going to let the Democrats go scot-free here. But here's the thing that folks need to be very clear about. We're talking about a bunch of junket-taking politicians who have never heard of the word copay on their health care, for God's sake. And see, this is, for me, at the root of what made the Republicans back up off of this. They don't want this sort of thing. They don't want to look up and see the front page of the Washington Post detailing each and every trip each and every one of them take. The newspaper would be nothing but trips.
Right, and as you said before the show, eventually people are going to look at this as like, well, what are they doing for us?
Yeah.
If they're out there smoking cigars, flying around the world, playing golf, having fancy breakfasts, what are they doing to help me out, to help our schools, to help us get health coverage, to bring down the cost of living a little bit, to bring down the cost of gas a little bit? These guys don't give a crap about us. What are they doing for us? But then, of course, there's the richer people that are like, hey, man, that guy, you know, he's living it.
Yeah.
You know, those are, but hopefully,
well, if I'm going to move my sweatshop to Singapore, he's what?
Right. But you know, as we know in this country, those are not the majority.
No.
And if the majority starts getting pissed off at the behavior of these people, that's their biggest fear, is that the people might actually expect them to do their jobs.
Yeah, they're looking ahead to next year's elections, and they are facing the very real possibility that the Democrats could retake one of the houses of Congress. That scares the bejesus out of them. They haven't gotten their agenda done yet.
Well, I'll tell you, this reaction to the nuclear option that we saw yesterday, the super secret, rule number 14,
mm-hmm.
where the Democrats in the Senate are setting out to set the agenda, even though they're not the majority, and it's a beautiful Democratic agenda that really serves the people of this country, and it really shows just how little the Republicans do that. They serve a certain minority group of this country, and they use a larger minority group to mobilize support for the people with the real money through God.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, boiling underneath all of this is the fact that dozens of Republicans who have gotten campaign donations from Tom DeLay's arm pack gave the money right back to Tom DeLay's legal defense. How do you like them apples?
Yeah, here you go. We don't want this is dirty money.
No. This is, okay, I get the money to run my reelection campaign,
yeah.
And then I take some of that same money and pass it right back over to the guy that gave it to me.
I see what you're saying. So they just funnel it back to you. Oh, you need it back because you're in trouble? Sure, here, take half of it. That's more like. Another success on behalf of the Democrats and certainly the AARP is that Social Security. The pitch is failing, and wherever George Bush goes to pitch it, he fails, and people just don't want anything to do with it. And now a bipartisan group of, congressmen and senators
yes.
are meeting with the higher-ups, the elders of AARP to discuss this, and we're going to cover that a little bit when we come back. And one of the reasons why they had such a hard time, getting the AARP to think about it was, a horrendous ad campaign that was done by the Swift Boat people. Then we have that ad because they pulled it, but we still have it. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Hello, this is Mick Foley, professional wrestler and best-selling author, and you're listening to the two guys who give the right wing the smackdown. It's Mark Maron and Mark Riley with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Wait for 30 days. Call now 1-800-900-2657. That's 1-800-900-2657.
One past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. There's the fax machine with the liberal agenda from the Streisand compounds. All right. Here, write these down, you guys. One, protest the maiden flight of the world's largest passenger plane, the Airbus A380, by pretending to forget your frequent flyer number when requesting the ovo-lacto vegetarian meal. God, complicated. Two, to alleviate your pet's trauma after getting spayed, give yourself a sympathy vasectomy. Three, now that the Ethics Committee is free to go after Tom DeLay, adjust the congressional probe setting to maximum penetration. Four, it's Take Your Daughter to Work Day. Introduce her to today's modern workplace by beating her head against the glass ceiling and having an executive grab her ass while you do it.
Oh,
sorry. I did. That was a harmonious ooh from me and Riley. Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. So George Bush retreated to his underground bunker yesterday. Wake up, sheeple. He's marrying Eva Braun, and we're all invited to the wedding.
Ooh.
Yeah. It's almost, that bit's almost dead, my friends. All right. So here we go. Let's talk about a couple of things. We are going to talk about the AARP in a few minutes. We're going to run that ad from the Swift Boats Veterans for Truth people in a few minutes, but we've got a couple other things to finish up in this hour. One being that not all Democrats are excited. Riley, am I right here?
Not all Democrats are excited. Not everyone is excited about all Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
In the Black Commentator, and for those of you who've never had an opportunity to look at it, it is an extraordinary online publication that's done by Glenn Ford, who I know actually used to work at the Mutual Black Network for many, many years. And this is a website, by the way, that pulls no punches in its political commentary about the black community. And the name of this particular cover story was Black Caucus Losing Cohesion.
Right.
And what is laid out here is a damning indictment of some members of the Congressional Black Caucus who have strayed off the ranch. Specifically, 10 of the 41 members of the CBC voted for the bankruptcy bill. 8 and not the, exactly the same eight, also voted yes on the repeal of the estate tax. And it is the Black commentator's position that these decisions on the part of these different members of the CBC was generally can generally be attributed to money. That corporate contributions are what is fueling this drive away from what they call an historic Black political agenda.
Okay.
All right. And that these votes by these different members of Congress, and many of them tend to be Southerners, people like Denise Majette in Georgia, David Scott in Georgia, Arthur Davis in Alabama, and others. These folks are generally straying off the ranch because they've got corporate contributions that kind of that they are beholden to the people that are funding them at this point.
So what's unique here is that, you know, instead of voting on behalf of the community, which they've done historically, they are now voting on behalf of corporate interests that are, you know, basically, you know, buying them out, which is meaning that they are acting like many other politicians.
Yeah, that they are acting much like many other politicians and against the interests of the African-American community. The number of Black people who are going to make out like bandits because of the repeal of the estate tax, you can count on one hand.
Do you know them?
Bob Johnson, the guy that used to own BET, that's the only one I can think of. And by the way, Bob Johnson was in Bush's corner on this from day one. But the 10 that they dogged about the bankruptcy bill, for example, are people like Harold Ford Jr., who intends to run for Bill Frist's Senate seat in Tennessee, Arthur Davis, who we mentioned, Greg Meeks, who's from right here in Queens, New York, Sanford Bishop from Georgia, David Scott from Georgia, William Jefferson from Louisiana, Albert Wynn from Maryland. And also Kendrick Meek and Al Green and Emmanuel Cleaver.
So what's interesting about this is that, like, you know, now you have, you know, politicians, you know, Black politicians voting, you know, sort of against the community interest. And you have, you know, that certainly happened with the Republicans. It happens with Democrats. But, you know, is there, what are the possibilities of a third party occurring in this country?
Well, see, this is where you get some very interesting polling, certainly inside the Black community. And it could make for an interesting coalition between people, for example, who are looking perhaps to form a third party that is internet-based, which is the subject of an article and an effort by Joe Trippi, who ran Howard Dean's operation.
Right. His assumption is that the amount of money you can mobilize almost overnight and the amount of momentum you can get on a cultural level almost overnight, he's basically, Trippi in his article, is saying that you could almost, you know, it's undeniable that it will eventually happen because you don't have to abide by the rules of campaigning. You don't have to abide by the rules of fundraising. Bam. MoveOn.org needs a couple $1 million. Bam. They got a mailing list that'll make it happen. Now, what do you think out there? Give us a call, 866-303-2270. At the practicality of this, is it true? Is he overestimating the power of the internet, really? Does the internet in and of itself, you know, alienate people who, you know, either one, don't have access to computers, don't have computers? Is it really as powerful as we think it is? Is it viable? How's that?
It's a very interesting question. I mean, there was some polling done that's not too long ago that said a virtual statistical majority of the Black community was prepared to support a third party. Not unless they're prepared to support an internet-based third party, but maybe so.
Well, this is like, let's hear from you. 866-303-2270. What do you think about the third-party internet option? And we'll be back. It's 6 past the hour, folks. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes. How are you? Progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. Good morning to you with your finger on the dial. ready to call the FCC. I know who you are. You know, Bush has got a new energy bill, and it says that the president discussed a plan to encourage building oil refineries on former military sites, you know, like Yellowstone, Yosemite, the Redwood National Forest, the Grand Canyon. Hello, Mark Riley. How are you?
I'm doing all right, man. How you doing?
Good. We're in the middle of a call extravaganza. We have taught, we put out the word to call us about this idea. Joe Trippi's got an idea. He's the old campaign manager for Howard Dean, and he's sort of given credit for the great internet explosion of raising campaign money and mobilizing people. And now he's speculating that it would be very probable and easy to mobilize people on the internet to create a viable third party in this country. And I don't know. I don't think it's true because I'm under the belief that, you know, taking action requires more than forwarding email or sending money over the internet. And Riley, you brought up a good point before.
Well, my point is simply this. When people start talking about a third party on a national level, they almost invariably talk about running someone for president. I believe that that kind of top-down strategy is doomed to failure. I think if you're going to run people for elected office from a third party, you need to start at the bottom. Run people for the state legislatures across the country because they make a lot of laws in most states. Run people for mayors of cities. Run people for governor. Run people for these different elected offices. And there are some parties that do that. The Green Party contests a lot of elections. There are parties. The Independence Party caused a lot of controversy here in New York when they run different people for elected office. So there are parties that run folks on that level. In fact, there is a woman on the New York City Council. Mm-hmm. That represents a party called the Working Families Party, which is what you might call a more progressive version of the Democrats. They want a living wage, not just a minimum wage. I mean, they've pushed for a number of different issues in this city, and they've been very effective. They haven't run anybody for president yet, but they're building from the grassroots up. And yeah. I think that any organizing that you do to contest elections has to be done that way, number one, and does and will eventually, if you want to fundraise on the internet, that's all well and good. If you want people to come out for you, to vote for you, you're going to have to go to their houses and knock on their doors and convince them. Yeah,
sure.
A little more.
Yeah, the Republicans generally use religious organizations to do this type of grassroots network.
Well, yeah, and they do the whole direct mail thing. That's Viguerie, Richard Viguerie's contribution to
aligned,
American body politics.
Who is aligned with the religious right in a
absolutely
big way. Well, let's talk to – we're taking calls, 866-303-2270. Rich, listening to 1190 WLIB here in New York. How are you, Rich?
Good morning. How you doing?
Good,
hey,
man.
Rich.
What's on your mind about the topic?
All right. Well, you know, as Mike Riley just said, you got to start from the ground up.
Yeah, absolutely.
You just can't impose it from top down and expect to get results. Excuse me. But more to the point, I really love to see us get back to a two-party system at least. until we solve the Diebold problem, I don't see that happening.
The Diebold machines, yeah, the black box voting machines. You know, and it's interesting. Thanks for your call, man. Because that Forrest Juarez, you know, he bailed. You know, the guy who was put in charge of election reform.
Yeah.
Was that a committee? Was it an office? Of
yeah, it was an organization whose job it was to help implement what's called HAVA, the Help America Vote Act.
Unfunded. Nobody got active. It didn't happen.
Yeah.
On either side, you know, there's been some sort of talk of legislation, some investigation. John Conyers, John Kerry, John Edwards have stepped forward and said we got to do some voter reform. But, man, I haven't heard much about it lately. Have you, Riley?
I haven't heard a word about it. That doesn't mean, by the way, because, you know, guys like John Conyers will stay on this forever.
Yeah.
So it's not because it's below the radar doesn't mean it's not happening, but it's certainly not a priority.
Yeah, he's right. It should be a priority to guarantee that we actually have a fair and reasonable voting system after what's happened for the last two elections. Meredith in Madison, Wisconsin, listening to the mic. How are you?
Hi, Meredith.
Hi. First of all, something from December.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Riley, the church you went to was St. Martin in the Field.
Yeah.
And Mark Maron, that was the church in Chariots of Fire.
Okay.
Where they were memorializing Harold Abrams.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's called St. Martin in the Field. It's a lovely church, medieval. So if you wanted to know, now you know.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Secondly, getting to the topic, my area of scholarship as an historian is from Wisconsin. and Madison.
Mm-hmm.
It's the home of progressivism.
Yes,
the original Progressive Party.
Mm-hmm.
The point was to break the lock of the two-party, very corrupt Gilded Age. So what was initiated was the direct primary.
Was that during the La Follette campaign?
Of course.
Yeah.
All
1924, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. Yes, look at Battle and Bob La Follette in Madison.
Okay.
Who was pushed up, forced to go what we would now call left, by the grassroots socialist party in Milwaukee, which had socialist mayors for 50 years.
So you're saying that...
The same is true of Toledo. The same is true of Rochester from 1890 to 19.
Okay. All right, so we got to do the grassroots thing. Thank you, Meredith. I think what she's saying is that even if the party, as you were saying, starts from the grassroots and may not have the intention of creating a presidential candidate, if they're powerful enough, they can move candidates around because the candidate has to accommodate some of their causes.
Yeah, and Meredith is talking about a very little-known part of American history. Bob La Follette did, in fact, run for president. He didn't win, obviously. There was no President La Follette. But it was built from a grassroots movement, and it was built by people out in Wisconsin who felt that, and the progressive remnants are still there in the city of Madison, where people have had a tradition of running as independent of the two major parties.
That's good. This is getting me excited. I'm ready to run.
You should run.
We've got an ex-gubernatorial candidate on the phone listening to 1190 WLIB here in New York. Tom Layton, good morning.
Tom Layton, how you doing?
Okay, guys. Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
I talked to you once when I was doing a show here on LIB. You're from the Marijuana Reform Party,
well,
right?
Well, I started with Jerry Brown, and then I was instrumental in the Green Party here in New York State.
Is that the same thing, the Green Party and the Marijuana Reform? I'm sorry.
My goal was to create a third party because the Democrats were not responding.
Right.
And I got some experience in this. I'd like to toss in some facts here. First of all, New York state law is different than any other state. Operating a third party here has different impact than it does anywhere else because of the allowing to add up all the votes in the different lines. So third party politics is different here than everywhere else. It won't work everywhere else because it's basically winner take all. And a third party is just going to help elect Republicans.
Okay.
I think what we need to do is take a lesson from the playbook of the Christian right, which in the early 80s got involved in politics, not just internet, clicking, writing a letter, calling in, sending some money, but, running for office, school board, and going, all the way and infesting that party and pulling it to the right.
Infiltrating the government.
If Ralph Nader had run as the Democratic Party primary, he would have helped to pull that entire party to the left. He would have been the darling candidate of the progressives instead of Nader, and the final platform and candidate would have reflected more of what he wanted. But all we can do as a third party is help elect Republicans and move the Democrats farther to the right.
It would have been Nader instead of Dean, I think, is what you're trying to say?
Pardon me?
You said Nader instead of Nader.
You were saying Nader instead of Dean, perhaps?
No, I'm saying that, if Nader had run with his primary,
he
would have captured the imagination and the hopes and aspirations of progressives, and he would have emerged as the insurgent candidate like Jerry Brown did in 92, and in process of raising his issues in full view of the public in the debates, would have brought the party to the left, and the final nominee in the platform would reflect that. And what we need to do is to pull the party from within, because if you go from without, it's only going to help the Republicans in the short term.
Yeah, but do you really think that? I mean, when you talk about, when you make a comparison of Jerry Brown and Nader, Jerry Brown was a pretty smooth operator and a real charismatic politician.
Oh, right, no.
And he didn't govern Oakland from the far left either.
No, he wasn't. But I'm talking about the idea of an insurgent candidate against the Democratic Party establishment.
Okay.
We only have one party. It's the party of money with two right wings.
Okay.
We need to make the Democratic Party the party of the people and more progressive but like it used to. The question is, do you do that from the outside by a third party, which forces them to take our rhetoric like they did with the socialists turn century, or to do it from the inside? And I think if we do it from the outside, we lose so much in the short term to the Republicans that it's going to take centuries to catch up. Whereas if we do it from the inside, we hold our ground while still pulling the party in the debate to the left.
So you're in agreement that grassroots movement is necessary by any means necessary, whether it's internet, whether it's pushing people to run for school boards. Yeah, absolutely.
There's no substitute for doing the hard work, boring, tedious stuff of doing politics ongoing year in, year out, running for office yourself, school board, and becoming part of the party itself.
Really? You mean I can't just forward an email and expect it to change?
No. Can I just call the radio station, send some money? No. That's what the Christian right did in the Republican Party, and they've moved it to the right.
Well, you have to also realize that they are compelled and driven by an ambitious fanaticism.
Are we?
Fanaticism, I'm not so sure.
Do we care about the environment and the poor and the...
Yes, we do.
Or not?
We do.
Okay,
but in your experience, have you found evidence of the type of fanaticism on a broadest base as the Christians have within our party? I mean, let's be honest here, Tom.
Oh, the problem is the progressives and the left say, oh, I don't want to do politics. I just work on my issues. So
right.
We're all fractionated in issues. We've
exactly.
We work together and put aside our passion for our issues and say, here's the big picture. Let's work together to achieve this and understand that in the process, our issues will get there, but, you know, we don't have to.
Hey, Tom, I got one quick final question for you. Where is the black in the picture?
That's my point. You know, if the Democratic Party doesn't respond to issues of the poor and minorities and working class people, they're not going to, you know, it's dividing things again.
Yeah, but see, you know, when Ralph Nader ran twice and people said, well, where are the black people in your campaign?
Well,
he was kind of standing there like Ralph Cramden going, humming, 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 I don't know.
Fault of his campaign. You're darn right.
Well, thank you for talking to us, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Take it easy.
Appreciate it.
Okay. He handled that like a real politician. There wasn't a beat there. It's 18 past the hour. We'll be back in a second. Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Rob Corddry from The Daily Show, here to remind you that when top news reporters and investigative journalists like me want their news skewed so far to the left it's wearing a dress, we turn to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Support our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Operation Truth. We were there.
Paid for by Operation Truth, Incorporated.
Next year, HarperCollins will proudly publish The Diary of Ronald Reagan. Morning Sedition has obtained these exclusive entries from the pen of the nation's 40th president.
Inauguration Day, January 20th, 1981. I was introduced to the nuclear football this evening. It wasn't a football at all, but a briefcase with coals and a satellite phone inside. Nobody thought it was funny when I threw it Hail Mary at Bushy. Jets were scrambled. I was thrown to the ground. Nancy took advantage of the confusion and went and smashed all the White House china that Rosalind had bought. Ooh, a bowling alley. I make a note to inquire about 10-pound balls. I'm a funny president. Uh-oh, sleep.
This has been another excerpt from The Diary of Ronald Reagan, brought to you by Morning Sedition.
23 past the hour, Mark Maron here, Mark Riley, it's Morning Sedition. Hey, you know, every morning we try to tackle the specifics of breaking stories out of Washington and around the world, and I really try to drill into what each specific story means, but sometimes, man, as some of you know, it overwhelms me a little and frankly sends me into a bit of a brain skid. Let's talk about Tom DeLay, because I suspect that a lot of people who really hate this guy secretly envy the freebies. And I think, you know, would I do it much differently, Riley? You know, I mean, who wouldn't want a free trip, a meal or two, maybe a tote bag, a baseball cap, a pen? The real question is, what are you willing to do for that free mouse pad? For most of us, the question is meaningless, because there's precious little we can do. It's different when you have a big say in running the country. That's why congressmen should be held to a higher standard of swag. Which is not to say that they rarely live up to it. I'm sure half the members of the House have an Enron windbreaker somewhere in the back of the closet. All that us little folks get from swag is the swag itself. Swag for swag's sake. But Tom DeLay doesn't just get a T-shirt that says, Surf the Mariana Islands. He gets an all-expense-paid first-class trip to Saipan so that he'll force through legislation making it legal for the local company that makes the T-shirt to pay their workers in puka shells. That's why they have an ethics committee in Congress. Do they have an ethics committee at Quiznos? No. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But what can you really do if you unleash the full force of the assistant manager position at Quiznos? dude, I'll just charge you for the 6-inch. An ethical violation, yes, but nobody has lost their pension. My point is this. There is swag, and then there is malignant swag. No one has ever bought me a trip in exchange for a favor. I'm excited if they fly me out for the gig. If they put me up in the courtyard suites that has a fridge in the room and a microwave so I can make popcorn, I feel like I'm getting away with something. I wish I were a little more shameless, but my power is limited. The owner of Sir Laugh-A-Lots is not taking me golfing in Scotland to get his comedy club exempt from child labor laws. Hell, I can barely fill the place as it is. I can't be bought. Or if I can, you people just aren't trying hard enough. Hence, I am not ethically challenged. Is it an ethical problem for me to say that I buy my fish at Marino Brothers Fish? No, because they're not paying me to say it. It's true. If they give me a deal on some fish, then that's a nice gesture on their part. The question is, if I get used to the deals on the fish and I start saying it every day and they continue to give me fish and perhaps offer me a couple of bucks to say that Joe's fish place down the street is bad and I had bad fish there and almost died and we put Joe's out of business and Marino's opened a second store and they start paying me regularly to talk about their fish and they open more and more stores until there's a Marino Brothers Fish Empire, and I'm their pitchman, and they start slipping gifts and money through lobbyists to pitchmen that start politicians like Tom DeLay to lift fishing restrictions everywhere, and they literally deplete all the oceans of fish and destroy the entire ecosystem, and we all live in domes because of it. Okay, well, you see, it's a slippery slope, folks. The important thing is the Marino Brothers do have some damn fine fish. Ultimately, it's a question of responsibility, and that's why we have to keep Tom DeLay's feet to the fire, because the politicians would not be blamed for the Marino Brothers ecosystem crashing fish empire. No, friends, that would probably be me. I would be blamed.
Ooh.
And that's your brain skip for today, which will segue us directly into the fact that the Washington Post says that DeLay should and might go down.
Yes. Yeah, the Washington Post is saying that. By the way, there is a cost for swag, but we'll talk about that on another day. Yeah, there is. I'm telling you. Woman got fired in Jersey.
For?
For using, this is a management woman at Costco, Kayla's favorite place. She was fired for using free coupons for fabric softener.
There you go.
True story. We got to get back to this delay.
Judd Legum is coming from the Center for American Progress to talk about the, hopefully, ultimate downfall delay.
Yeah. Yeah. And it may be coming. We'll find out why and when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
The smartest guys in the room shall be joined by Alex Gibney, the director of the musical on Enron. That's right, the musical. This week on the Majority Report, Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Tradition. You know, man, I'm not going to be able to make it down to Steve Wynn's brand new multi-billion-dollar casino in Vegas this weekend, but that doesn't mean I can't do a little gambling right here with our own Inside the Beltway odds maker, Johnny Casey. There he is. Johnny, where's the action, man?
It follows me, baby.
Yeah.
This week it's all about Tom DeLay again. Hammer time, the bug man. I've got ethics committee action out the wazoo.
All right, so where's the smart money, Johnny?
Well, here's a sure bet for you guys.
All right.
DeLay never seeing the inside of Air Force One ever again. You'll see Bin Laden in the cockpit before that happens, baby. That's going off at 100 to 1. I put at least 5 units on that one.
Hey, Johnny, the cash is burning my fingers. What else you got?
The Mondo action this week. If there's a Democratic filibuster, how's it going to go down? 100 to 1? Kennedy names every single woman JFK slept with. That should take a week. He was a fun guy.
Whoa, 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 whoa. You knew JFK?
He dated my sister briefly, if you know what I mean. I handed him a lemonade once, then a Secret Service guy threw me out of her bed. I'll never forget. You want a hot filibuster bet? You
absolutely.
Want to make some money?
Yeah.
Kerry has a flashback and scares the perimeter. He holds off Capitol Police for a week until Barbara Boxer forcibly disarms him. That's 2 to 1.
All right, I'll put a soft buck on that one.
I'll put a soft buck on that one. Yeah, okay.
There's a big expose about American Idol coming up. You must have some American Idol action.
Action? That's putting it mildly. If they think their phones get jammed, they should have been answering my phones this week. The big bet is, did Paul Abdul sleep with any of the contestants? Are you kidding me? 6-1, she didn't sleep with all of them. And a few audience members, too. That's a lock. Get your money down on that one.
Is there any way I can get a shot at... Yeah, never mind. Go ahead.
Talk to me. There's a lot of ways you could go on Idol action this week. 1,001, Simon Cowell has never touched a female contestant. But 2-1, he pays to watch Randy Jackson. Trust me, take that bet. You'll thank me later. Yeah, that's like, straight from Johnny K. Street.
I got
to
my
you.
Wallet out, man. I'm going to put 20 on that one.
Believe me, that's a good bet.
Okay. So, yeah, what else? You hear things? What's going on?
I hear things. I know people. I know people who know other people, if you get my drift.
I think so. I think so. You think the fix was in on American Idol or what?
Absolutely. Who are we kidding here? I've heard guys getting their thumbs broken that sang better than those people.
Hey, wait a minute, Johnny. I got my lucky socks on, man. What's the long shot this week?
The long shot? You ready? Get your money out.
Right.
The long shot is Paul Abdul has a menage a trois with Tom DeLay and Tony Perkins on a Scottish golf course during a trip paid for by Jack Abramoff. That's going off at $2,000,001.
Wow.
You hit that, they'll be taking your picture on a beach with Angelina Jolie.
Well, wait a minute. What have I got to lose? I'm going to put $5 on that, too. What the hell do I care? Thanks for dropping in, Johnny.
See you next week.
Yeah.
Then Mark, don't forget the thing I told you about the thing with the people and the thing.
I'm not going to forget that thing. I'm not going to forget that thing. I got it. Take care. And be careful with the thing.
All right.
All right. That's Johnny K Street.
Yeah.
So here we go. I just walked out with $50 in my $50.
Wow.
What do you say? $2,000,001 on that Paul Abdul?
Riley, tell me more about this. I want to understand this Washington Post piece.
About DeLay likely to be found culpable.
Yeah.
Here's Tom DeLay's conundrum, dilemma, paradox, whatever.
Yeah.
He, in order to be vindicated by this House Ethics Committee, Tom DeLay is going to have to convince these people that he really didn't know anything about where the money came from for these trips, and he took many.
Yeah.
And he's got to convince them that he should not have had to know where this money came from. In other words, if it was on Jack Abramoff's credit card, he's not supposed to know that.
Right.
If it's on Ed Beckham's credit card, he's not supposed to know
but
that.
But theoretically, you are not allowed to have trips paid for by lobbyists.
No, that's true. But what he's going to say is, look, I didn't know the lobbyists paid for the trip. I thought it came from this foundation. And the foundation is not a lobbying group per se. That's how he's going to try and defend himself.
So it's going to come down to just, ridiculous. It's going to come down to him trying to prove that the organization didn't present itself as a lobbying organization. Where everybody knows, everyone in Congress certainly knows that he knew Jack Abramoff was at the head of the thing.
Well, yeah. And what this piece is actually saying, Mark, we can draw a real good analogy here.
Mm-hmm.
You had Gator when you were down in Florida, right?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
But, when an alligator has prey in its mouth and starts flipping around, the prey very rarely gets loose.
Mm-hmm.
Apply that to Tom DeLay. He's got the House Ethics Committee and, to some extent, the American people outside of his district scrutinizing him very carefully. The likelihood is he will not come out of this unscathed, even if he maintains his majority leader post. And I'm not sure he's even going to be able to hold on to that.
All right, let's talk about what you and I were talking about earlier, which is that what would be another tactic that the Republicans are using this Ethics Committee for? Why are they saying that this is a go-ahead on to putting the rules back? And now, what are the possibilities of them just stalling these things, of not agreeing to the terms of the investigation for as long as it takes for the window? Is it, 45 days?
Well, no.
Days?
Initially, in the rules change, it was supposed to be 45 days. And that 45 days was put there very deliberately to kill any investigation after a month and a half. Now they're talking about the possibility of either 90 to 120 days. That has not been finalized as far as I know.
Well, let's say if Tom DeLay's shenanigans are driving you crazy and you wish there was something you could do to get involved in bringing about this downfall, check out www.dropthehammer.org. Right now on the phone, Judd Legum, Research Director with Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. joins us to tell us all about it. How are you, Judd? What is Drop the Hammer all about?
Well, Drop the Hammer is a site that we developed, and basically it's a way for consumers to contact the companies that have been donating to Tom DeLay's legal defense fund and And basically, there's a number of things that we have we tell these companies, but basically the message is, you know, you can either support Tom DeLay or you can have our support, and to tell these companies to stop giving money to his legal defense fund for the money that they have given back.
All right, well, lay out some of these companies just for me.
American Airlines, Bacardi, Nissan USA, RJR, Reynolds.
Mm-hmm.
Those are some of the companies we're targeting.
Is Verizon on there? I heard Verizon was on there.
Verizon is on there.
Oh, what am I going to do about that?
Can you say singular?
I guess so. So, is there also a radio campaign or what else? What are you doing along the lines
of? Well, what we've done is we've gotten about 17,000 people who have sent emails to these companies through our site. We've gotten American Airlines. They've had to respond in the press. They've come up. They say that, well, he just didn't have enough money to pay his own legal bills, so we stepped in and helped him.
But you could probably put American Airlines out of business. I think they're... It's not going to take much.
I don't know
much.
How much of an accomplishment that would be.
Exactly.
You know, it's interesting that DeLay says he doesn't have enough money to pay his bills. He certainly wasn't spending the money on the trips he took.
That's right.
That's true. And he had plenty of money to give to us. He had $500,000 to give to his wife and his daughter. For
apparently, they're not willing to lend it back to him.
Yeah.
They don't trust the guy.
Now, Judge, let me ask you a question that I'm absolutely stumped about.
Yep.
Now, apparently dozens of Republican lawmakers, including people like, for example, Dana Rohrabacher, Clay Shaw, and others, have donated money to, well, actually got money from DeLay's Political Action Committee, ARMPAC, and then took that money and donated it right back to DeLay's legal defense. Now, I assume it might be legal, but is it ethical?
Well, I think there's some serious ethical questions about it, especially if there was a tacit understanding that this money would definitely or at least could be funneled back into his legal defense fund. You can't use these different entities as a conduit from one to the other. So I think that's the open question, and it really raises serious questions, especially since if you look what he did in Texas, that's exactly what he was doing. He was taking corporate money, which isn't allowed to go in these races, funneling it through his state political action committee called TRIMPAC and funding those candidates.
You know, if he was a drug dealer, they'd call this money laundering.
That's right. That's one word to call it. And the only question is, you know, is this the same money? But in a lot of cases, if you look at that New York Times article this morning, it really looks like the same money, $5,000 given early in the year, and then later in the year, $5,000 given right back to the legal defense fund.
So there's really no way that Tom DeLay can plead ignorance on this stuff. So what is this? What do you think this whole ethics committee investigation is going to hinge on? What are some of the obstacles?
Well, a huge obstacle is the fact that all five Republican members of the committee have financial ties to Tom DeLay,
mm-hmm.
either directly to his defense fund, gotten money from his political action committee. These are his biggest defenders. So it's hard to have a fair trial when the juries are all of your best, you know, the juries made up of your best friends. So that's I think, the biggest obstacle. But also the obstacle is sorting through all of these documents, these thousands of documents, and trying to come up with a fair outcome through all of this very heightened political atmosphere.
So now what can people do to get involved here, Judd?
Well, there's a number of things to do. The easiest thing to do, you can go to dropthehammer.org. You can put in your name. You can send a letter to these companies and tell them you don't want to be involved even indirectly in funding Tom DeLay's legal defense. So that's what we're asking them to do. And we're also going to put some radio ads on the air to try to get these companies a little bit worried about what's going on out here in the country. And you can listen to the ads right on our site, too, dropthehammer.org.
Judd, a point of clarification. Do you know exactly how long an investigation of the Ethics Committee can hang now before it goes away under the old rules that were just reapproved yesterday?
Well, the old rule's 45 days.
It is 45 days.
It's 40. We're going back just to the old rules as if before they, you know, screwed them up this year. Back to the old Congress. It's 45 days, and then an investigation will go forward. But that period really isn't relevant now because the Republicans have said they want an investigation. So an investigation should start in sooner than 45 days is what's going to happen. and that investigation will probably take from 6 months to a year.
If you were a gambling man, would you say that DeLay can get away with pleading ignorance about who funded all these trips?
I think he's going to have a very difficult time because of all of the records and the evidence that shows that he should have, especially the extensive contacts between DeLay's staff and Jack Abramoff. I think that's really going to be a sticking point for DeLay as this goes forward.
Judd Wagham, Research Director, Center for American Progress, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Okay,
thanks,
you take care. The website, again, is dropthehammer.org, www.dropthehammer.org. When we come back,
nice try.
46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Hi, this is former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. Remember me? I helped preside over the greatest economic expansion in our nation's history, creating over 20 million new jobs during Clinton years. I'm sorry to hear that the Bush administration has either outsourced or eliminated your job entirely. But while you're waiting for things to turn around, stay tuned to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning. Sir, Mr. President, how much do you think this war is going to cost? About $100.
Uh-oh, what?
You can't make it up like this.
Next year, HarperCollins will proudly publish The Diary of Ronald Reagan. Morning Sedition has obtained these exclusive entries from the pen of the nation's 40th president.
March 30th, 1981. What a glorious morning. Today, I think I'll invite my good friend and press secretary, James Brady, to go with me to the Washington Hilton. Won't he be tickled? Note to self, plan a grand dinner with my NRA buddies. Uh-oh, bathroom.
This has been another excerpt from The Diary of Ronald Reagan, brought to you by Morning Sedition.
51 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. How's everybody doing? It is Thursday. Mark Reilly and I are here,
hey,
as usual. And now, some liberals will never... Yes, some liberals. It always starts like that with me sometimes, doesn't it? Where is what I'm looking for? How come, like, if I have one... You know, Passman, Dan Passman, son of Lewis and Linda Passman, always asks me, you know, if he's going to go to the store to get some coffee, does he want me to go to the regular place or does he want me to go to Starbucks? Because when I have Starbucks, he has a concern. His concern is that we're being taken advantage of because they add caffeine to it. My concern is, like, that sounds good, the added caffeine. So, of course, when he brings me the Starbucks, now my brain has locked in some sort of caffeinated seizure, but that's okay. It's late enough in the day for that to happen in terms of the show. Some liberals will never run out of their boutique issues, and apparently they will never run out of reasons to email us about them. So we've decided to devote a little time each week to saluting the latest cause someone is trying and failing to get us to adopt. Here now is the Morning Sedition Nice Try Cause of the Week.
Nice try.
This is an email we got from someone going by the handle NCSPCA. This is already, it's already looking bad.
What?
Here's what it says. Hey guys, I love you both, but please change the segment titled Dog of the Week. Why should we denounce man's best friend like that? Okay, now this is getting a little ridiculous, all right? Look, in case you don't know, Dog of the Week is what Mark Reilly labels some particularly underhanded and usually unintelligent member of the country's power structure each Friday. Dog of the Week is no more a reflection of real dogs than, say, flipping the bird is a reflection on real birds.
Nice try!
The email continues. Creep of the Week, or some other title, would be so much more appropriate and appreciated by our wonderful canine companions, end quote. Okay, maybe I'm just...
They
not...
listen to the radio?
Exactly. Maybe I'm just not sensitive enough, but I really don't think we're actually disparaging dogs, all right? If you took the time to notice, your dog probably doesn't think so much, doesn't think so either, all right? Hell, he doesn't really think at all. Crotch sniffing and tail chasing are definitely higher on his list of priorities than worrying about whether or not he's been unjustly compared to Tom DeLay or Bill Frist.
Nice try!
So... NCSPCA, if that is your real name.
Yeah.
Your intentions are noble and your love of animals is obviously shared by me, but your plea for us to change the name of our segment because it offends your dog earns you the label of Morning Sedition's Nice Try Cause of the Week, and possibly even Mark Reilly's Dog of the Week.
Could be.
All right.
Nice try.
So this is interesting. We had a conversation about this yesterday, that Bush is signing a bill to let parents, well, not let parents, but that he's signing a bill to allow this machine that will basically, you know, cut your DVD.
Yeah.
That way, if you put it in and you program it, you push a button, it will take out the cussing, it'll take out the nudity, it'll take out anything questionable, and it's already programmed. The machine is programmed to do that. Now, obviously, some, you know, entertainment companies, some movie production places had a problem with this and decided that, you know, well, maybe you should kick us a little change if you're going to start cutting up our product. Apparently, that's what they do with airline versions of movies,
yeah,
which I didn't know. And also, there are other problems with this. My personal issue is, I think once you buy the DVD, if this is the machine, if the machine does this because you want to, you know, you don't want your kids to see something, but it also plays it regular, you're not literally, you're not pirating the DVD, or you're not, you're also not changing it or selling it or anything else, I guess it saves some parents some time.
I guess it may save some parents some time, but I mean, what do they do with porn?
Yeah.
I mean, would you just get like a blank screen through the entire thing?
You get a lot of this. Hi.
Yeah. Hi.
And then the
and
credits.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you have to do to get your money's worth here? Look, I have a very basic problem as a parent with technology that is supposed to replace parenting. You don't want your kids to watch nudity, then don't buy product with nudity in it.
Yeah.
Don't, you know, allowing a machine to do what you're supposed to do is the punk's way out of this.
Yeah.
You raise a child by setting an example, not by throwing a switch,
so
not by hitting the remote.
You're saying that if you raise the child properly, they will naturally kind of respond to, I shouldn't be watching this. My parents told me I shouldn't be watching this, so I'm not going to watch it. You know, which I think is noble.
Well, when you're young, you can look, my daughter is 8 years old. She does not read anything with bad words in it. If she sees a bad word, she puts whatever it is down and says, I'm not reading that. It's a bad word. That's her. Now, she may not feel that way when she's 12. I don't know. But I do believe that you have to, at some point, parent. You have to be. And parenting, to me, means that you lead by your example. If you don't watch Blood and Gore, maybe your kids won't watch Blood and Gore.
Or else shut the door, you know, and tell the
shut
kids
the
that
door.
It's not for them, you know, whatever it is you're watching. I understand what you're saying, but it seems to me that a lot of people are overextended, and that doesn't necessarily mean they're doing it on purpose or that they're bad parents, but they work two jobs, they got to come home, they got to get dinner ready, and if their kids want to watch The Matrix, which, you know, should be, you know, it's not a horrible movie, but, you know, a guy gets his head blown off, and they just want to push this button so they know the kid's in the other room, and he's not going to come in and go, what's in a head?
Oh, yeah,
well, I don't want
yeah,
that to happen right. to Daddy, that they should be able to, you know, to push that button. I think it's not undermining or censoring the product itself in terms of
encourage the movie business to do what the record business has done, and that is to put out versions without the head getting blown off.
All right.
Easily done.
Well,
edit it.
What do you think? 866-303-2270 about this idea. It is an extension of the V-chip. Does it work? Are you against it? Is it censorship? Is it wrong? You know the questions. We'll be back in a second on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
If you're a horse owner, you should know that West Nile virus remains a deadly threat for virtually every horse in the U.S. Protect your champion with West Nile Innovator, the original West Nile virus vaccine. No West Nile vaccine has been proven more effective or protected more horses with more than 16 million doses safely administered coast to coast. Ask your veterinarian for West Nile Innovator today or visit equinewestnile.com from Fort Dodge Animal Health.
Good news about Aleve for those with arthritis pain. Reports are out about an independent government panel. According to the New York Times, several panel members said that patients in need of pain relief should first try naproxen, sold as Aleve, before COX-2 inhibitors. Forbes.com says the committee considered naproxen to be the safest NSAID from a cardiovascular standpoint. If you suffer from arthritis, ask your doctor about the good news. Ask your doctor about Aleve. Use is directed for minor arthritis pain.
You love your garden. You love the fresh produce, the money you save, and the pride that comes from working the soil. But it's never been an easy chore. Until now. I'd like to send you a free information kit that shows how easy gardening can be with a Matus Tiller Cultivator. It's so light and easy to use, you can cultivate an entire average-sized garden in only 20 minutes without breaking a sweat. And at only 20 pounds, anyone can handle it. But in spite of its light weight, it'll cut through sod and even the toughest, rockiest soil with ease. The Matus is so easy to handle, even in tight places. Even in hard soil, it'll dig down 10 inches deep. It's so much fun to use, you'll want to plant a second garden. But the Metis does more. With optional attachments, you can aerate and dethatch your lawn, edge around walks and driveways, even trim hedges.
Call 1-800-211-8001 now for our complete information kit and a free video showing how easy it is to use the Metis Tiller Cultivator. Put the fun back in gardening. Call now 1-800-211-8001. That's 1-800-211-8001.
This is Air America Radio News. Good morning. I'm Wayne Gilman. President Bush tonight meets the press and addresses the nation on the issues of Social Security and the sharp rise in the price of gasoline. Bush has called on the television networks to broadcast a primetime event in a bid to reach every American. It will be his sixth news conference since his reelection. It also comes at a time when the president is doing poorly in the polls over the issue of Social Security reform, the economy, and now the nation's burgeoning energy crisis. Bush intends to push Congress to pass along his long-stalled energy bill. Most experts say the president's plan will not produce a quick fix to the high price of gasoline. As for Social Security, the president's news conference is said to be timed with the conclusion of the administration's tour to convince Americans to support his plan for revamping Social Security. As predicted, members of the House voted overwhelmingly to reverse Republican-written rules that led Democrats to shut down the Ethics Committee. Republicans were far from enthusiastic from backing the resolution, but saw it as the only way out of the impasse with the Democrats. The final vote was 406-20. In the debate, the Democrats continued to attack the conduct of House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. Republicans countered that they did not make a mistake, but accepted political reality. Former Vice President Al Gore yesterday blamed Republican lust for one-party nomination for the GOP campaign to change Senate rules on filibustering judicial nominees. Gore also took aim at religious zealots for driving the effort. Gore maintains that changing the rules on the filibuster would result in a breakdown in the separation of powers serving the nation some 230 years. Gore also lashed out at those Republicans who threatened and intimidated judges after recent court rulings warning that independent judges would cower for fear of retribution. Leadership of the Family Research Council, Tony Perkins, remains hopeful to have had an impact on last weekend's Justice Sunday. It was an event to portray Democrats as being against people of faith. Perkins was able to enlist the support of Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist and others to get his message across, but reports this morning raised questions on whether Frist knew he was sharing the stage with someone with longstanding ties with racist organizations. It turns out 4 years ago, Perkins addressed the Louisiana chapter of the Council of Conservative Citizens, America's premier white supremacist group. Perkins also aligned himself with the former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, David Duke, paying him $82,000 for his mailing list. Perkins last Sunday, however, positioned himself beside a black preacher and a Catholic civil rights activist to give out phone numbers to those in the U.S. Senate who have been wavering on President Bush's judicial nominees. Wayne Gilman, Air America Radio News.
This news report is brought to you by Orkin Pest Control. Orkin offers free inspections to prevent termites from eating you out of house and home. Remember, if it bugs you, bug the Orkin Man at 1-800-ORKIN-MAN.
You're sorry you're late? No, no, no. You're not late. You're 45 minutes late. I've been sitting here by myself waiting for you for 45 minutes. Do you have any idea how that makes me feel? Say something.
Keep your voice down.
You know what's wrong with gay marriages? The same things that are wrong with straight ones. Support same-sex marriage. A message from PFLAG and equalmarriage.ca.
If you're a Medicare beneficiary, you must listen to this message. But first, get a pen and be ready to write down an important phone number I'm going to give you in just a moment. Did you know if you have a medical condition that prevents you from walking in your home, help is available? And it may cost you absolutely nothing. That's right. If you have Medicare Part B coverage and a supplemental insurance policy, you could pay nothing out of pocket for a mobility power chair or scooter from Scooters Unlimited. Scooters Unlimited can help set you free, bringing you independence through sexual mobility. You don't need to be confined to your chair another day. Call Scooters Unlimited right now. Do you have that pen? Here's the number.
Call 877-757-2668.
Call Scooters Unlimited right now at 877-757-2668.
There's no obligation, and pre-qualification is absolutely free. Even the phone call is free.
Call 877-757-2668. That's 877-757-2668. Call right now.
Head driving to Valero. Gotta fill her up fast. Fill my tank to the brim with the foreman's gas. You're driving to Valero.
Vroom, vroom, vroom.
I'll make a turn for the better.
Vroom, vroom, vroom.
You're driving to Valero with all the vroom you need.
Get more vroom for your buck. Valero. Value, variety, vroom.
How can I keep her safe when she always seems to be running away from me? It used to be so much easier to find solutions to her problems. Now, I don't even understand the questions, let alone have any answers.
The Girls and Boys Town National Hotline can help you find those answers. We've been working with teenagers for over 50 years and would like to share what we've learned about parenting. Call us toll-free, 1-800-448-3000.
Time furnished by the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
Hi, it's Al Franken. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Abu Ghraib prison torture scandal. Next time on my show, we'll be marking the anniversary of Abu Ghraib with expert Scott Horton, Jim Zogby, the head of the Arab American Institute, and Brian Anderson, the author of South Park Conservatives, Ruthless Examination of Abu Ghraib, the Middle East, and Al Franken. Next time on the Al Franken Show.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
This morning sedition on Air America Radio. We're talking about President Bush signing a bill that will let, parents will let this company edit DVDs, as you watch them or before you watch them. It's a computer program in a machine that you can hook up to your DVD player. You put a DVD in, it'll scan it for sexual content, for language content. Obviously, some of the entertainment companies are angry that they are editing their product, that the government is getting in the way of their product and not compensating them for this process. I mean, personally, I understand this. If you don't have time to parent your kids properly, to instill in them values that would enable them to not watch certain things until they're the proper age to do so, it makes sense. But it's still a hot issue, Riley.
Oh, it's an extremely hot issue because, first of all, the Bush administration has ensured the future financial viability of this company, ClearPlay, which is, by the way, based in Utah. How much you want to bet Orrin Hatch had something to do with the stuff inside the law?
Of course. What's the real truth behind it?
Hey, but, I mean, look, if this is what people think they need to keep their kids from smut, that's fine. I just think that there are other ways to do this. You can do it by editing the film, let the studios edit the film so that the stuff isn't there. Or if you really don't like this kind of stuff, you think Hollywood is producing, then don't watch it.
Exactly. It's the same thing. It's like, look, Fox News already filters out truth.
Yeah.
Without having, and that's just a choice on your cable. You know what I mean? You can just turn the channel. It doesn't mean, is it a step? Is it a slippery slope towards a slow stifling of all sexual content, of all, obscenity? Absolutely not. There's too much money in that, and it's part of what we all go through as human beings, and it's some people like that in their movies.
See, my thing is, this is filtering technology. When they pass legislation like this, there's always an unintended consequence. Let's wait 5 years and see what happens.
Okay. Well, here, let's talk to Rich listening to XM in Chicago. Good morning, Rich. What
do
you think?
Hey, good morning, guys.
What's on your mind?
No, I just want to say that I totally agree with Riley. Like, I don't think that the technology should be used as a substitute for, like, hard-nosed parenting.
Uh-huh.
His daughter learns from him, and, like, I learn from my parents. And technology is never going to replace that.
And also, honestly, Rich, isn't it true that you're going to learn from your parents, you're going to have that in place, and eventually you're going to run into some kids or some weirdo that's going to want to show you something, or you're going to be on the Internet as a kid, and if that is in place because you were properly parented, you will know, like, I don't want to be part of this, I don't want to watch this, I don't want to do this.
Well, when I was growing up, my dad had a constant saying, and as I get older, I find myself thinking that way. It's like, if you don't see me doing it, figure it wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
And so I think of that when I'm like, oh, you know, that's probably not a great idea. But a good story is when I was in college, I was, you know, working a part-time job at a video store, a Blockbuster. And, of course, they give you the worst hours possible. And this lady brought in her four kids with her, and she brings up this movie, Half-Baked.
Yeah.
And puts it down on the counter and looks me, like, sternly in the eyes and says, does this movie have any nudity in it? And I stared at her blankly. I'm like, no, it doesn't have any nudity in it whatsoever.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that was her only concern. And these 11, 12-year-old kids, you know, are being, you know, exposed to ideas that maybe they're too young for, but her only concern was nudity.
Yeah, there's a hypocrisy to it because who knows? Maybe she was planning on smoking some reefer while she was watching it with her kids.
Well, all these kids came back smelling a certain way. I can tell you that.
Oh. All right, Rich. Thanks, buddy. Hey, look, it's our old pal Chuck D on the line. How are you, Chuck?
Yo,
what's
Chuck.
Going on?
What's up?
What's up, Mark Squares?
How you doing, man?
I'm good. I'm just listening to Loud and Clear, the new transmitter down here at Air Atlanta.
All right.
You guys are booming, sounding real good, so I'm on the highway. And I was listening to the topic, and I just finished speaking at Buffalo State last night and just got down here. But, you know, I don't know. It's, you know, when it comes down to trying to edit, you know, DVDs and asking for the companies to do it, they're not going to do that.
Right.
I just think that, you know.
But, Chuck, don't record companies at this point edit songs or edit whole albums so they have a clean version and an explicit version?
Yeah, but these movie companies are a whole other monster.
Yeah, but I got a bigger problem with that, don't you, Chuck? I mean, like, shouldn't the artist be able to express what they want and trust the company to put out what they express? And if it should be up to the consumer to decide whether to listen to something or not or to filter themselves or not?
Well, I think it should be up to the parents to try to navigate their children through whatever is out there in the world.
Yeah.
But then, you know, here's another thing. It's like, you know, you have the advent of the remote. So there's always surfing. So a child is bound to run into, like, you know, some kind of porn channel or something. So I think the apparatus built into the device for parents is, I don't think that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
But see, now they also have devices that allow you, a lot of cable systems allow you to block channels where there is nudity. So if a child does surf, they're not going to hit that channel.
Yeah, but some parents can't even set the time on their old VCR. So.
Yeah. Well, I tend to agree with Chuck. I think that, you know, ultimately, you know, if it's going to help out a little bit at home and it's not, you know, imposing the morality on anybody else and it will aid in parenting. You know, like, you know, it's sort of a safeguard that, you know, what the hell? I mean, the kids are going to see it eventually anyway, so you got to do the good parenting. And if you're going to be in the other room, you know, cooking something, and you don't want the kid to see the part where the guy gets his head blown off or the two of them are naked and, you know throwing Jell-O at each other.
Okay, but suppose it. All right, now the kid doesn't see it, right?
Yeah.
Kid goes into school the next day, and one of his classmates said, did you see that part where the guy's head got blown off?
And they say, no, because my parents don't like me to see that.
Or they say,
my
no,
parents got a machine.
Can I come over to your house and watch the real version later?
Right, and then they come home crying and said, I'm glad you told me not to watch that.
Well, all these are good points, and I want to hog up the air. Guys are sounding good, and we'll talk about it over lunch.
There you go.
Chuck.
All right, Chuck, man, take care.
All right.
Bye.
You know, Chuck travels more than any other human being. He was in Buffalo State, upstate New York yesterday. He's in Atlanta this morning.
It's fun to be on the road, man. Yeah. Patty in New York, how are you, Patty?
Hey, Patty.
I have a 14-year-old daughter, so I'm kind of in this mode already.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's like the abstinence education. You're going to sit there and say, okay, if I don't show them the violence, they won't be exposed to it. And like you said, what happens when they go over their friend's house?
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the machine. They're going to be seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want her to watch the movie Hollow Man. That was one movie I seen, and I really didn't want her watching it. Well, I come to find out a couple months ago that she saw it.
Yeah.
Friend's house and saw it. So what did... me not bringing it in the house and not letting her see it accomplish, except that then she went to a friend's house and, oh, let's go get Hollow Man.
Yeah, I would.
Did you ground her?
No.
But I mean, but what?
I'm with already.
Huh?
What was the point? fine. It was over with already.
Well, what was Hollow Man? Was that scary or violent? Which was it?
I didn't like it. He becomes invisible, and while he's invisible, he rapes a woman. And that's what I really didn't like.
Yeah.
A lot of horror stuff. And I'm fine with that. I call it Stephanie King, you know?
Yeah.
Stephanie King.
Did you sit down with your daughter and say, look, this is the reason why I wouldn't want you to see it? Because
And that was my mistake. I should have. Well, now I rented Fast Times at Ridgemont High. We're going to watch it together. So, you know, it's like I should have sat down with her and watched it together and said, this is what I don't like. This is why I didn't want you seeing it. That would have been the more realistic approach to the situation, and that was a mistake on my part, and that's one of the reasons I didn't ground her, because I think I handled it wrong.
Yeah, you dropped the ball in instilling guilt.
Guilt like you cannot believe.
Uh-oh. She sounds like she's experienced in the guilt game.
Thank you for calling, Patty.
Thanks, Patty.
Yeah, I understand. Well, that's ultimately what it comes down to, is that my parents were always of the ilk where it's like, you know, if you're going to do this, you let us know. Let us talk to you about it. Be safe. With everything, it was never sort of like, no. It was sort of like, maybe we should do it with you. That would be
weird.
Oh,
no, not mine. Mine were like, no, and if you get caught, I'm going upside your head, period.
Right. Oh, man, tell us about the time your mom caught you with pot.
Oh, didn't I do that already? This is my mom. The first time I got really stoned on pot, it was across the street at this guy, John. We were in the treehouse, and we were smoking some pot.
Uh-oh.
And it was in the middle of the day, and it was only maybe the first time I smoked it. And I walk back across the street. I must have been 14 or 15. I walk back across the street to my house, and I walk in, and my mother just looks at me, and she goes, are you stoned? And I go, yeah. And she goes, well, then why don't you go to your room and play guitar? They say you play better when you're like that. And I'm like, okay, is that a punishment?
Oh, wow.
So I did.
Did she buy you a new Stratocaster after?
For some reason, I had this, I had a Marshall. That's the way my parents are. And I can't say that I cannot recommend that people, parent the way my parents parent, obviously, because, look at me. I got problems, and I'm not blaming them. But I am grateful for a lot of things. I'm grateful that my parents were open-minded, and they engaged me in, learning about art, about music, about, and talking to me frankly about sex and about drugs, and they never hid anything in terms of that stuff from me.
Oh, mine did. I mean, my father, when I was like 9 or 10 years old, drops Ivanhoe in my lap and says, you'll read this.
Mm.
And I mean, very matter of fact, that's how my family works.
I wish I had more of that. I wish I had. The only regret I have about my upbringing is I actually wish I had a little more discipline, a little more incentive
It's overrated. No, I'm only kidding.
No, but even if it's overrated, even if you hate it, what you have instilled in you from early on is the ability to sort of get things done, to have some follow through, to commit to something and do the work. It's just a work thing. It's like getting the work done and making sure it's like do the homework. It's like I don't want it, but you know what? It's only going to help you in the future.
I know, but I never. Oh man, homework. Oh,
yeah.
So we could talk for the rest of the day about it.
I don't even remember doing any. It's 17 past the hour. Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Experts now. 800-396-9711. 800-396-9711. That's 800-396-9711.
Next year, HarperCollins will proudly publish The Diary of Ronald Reagan. Morning Sedition has obtained these exclusive entries from the pen of the nation's 40th president.
August 5th, 1981. Today I replaced all of the striking air traffic controllers. Whatever they do, the only important union is the Screen Actors Guild. Uh-oh, jelly bean alarm.
This has been another excerpt from The Diary of Ronald Reagan, brought to you by Morning Sedition.
Yes, 22 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
It is Morning's Edition. Hang out, folks, because Phil Lesh is coming. You understand he's going to be? I can't believe a member of the Grateful Dead is going to be sitting in that chair.
In this room.
Am I being a little fanny? A little kind of fannish?
Yeah.
I'm excited.
You're
alive. All right. Since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So now on the phone, once again, is Planet Bush Bureau Chief Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Good morning, Mark.
God making gumbo. Why don't you jump on in the pot?
Okay, yeah, I will do that. I'm reading this piece in The Guardian. It says that your boy Bush is already headed towards becoming a lame duck just 5 months after his election. What do you think about that, huh? Lame duck, Lawton.
Well, I never condone that kind of hate speech.
Come on.
That sort of language, completely inappropriate for a morning program. Hey, we're disgusting.
Can I read you something, Lawton?
All right. If it's without the potty talk.
I know. Okay. All right. Quote, the president bullied made reform of the Social Security his top priority, and he's traveling around the country to court public opinion on his pet project.
Yes.
So far, the public is resisting, and Bush is making little headway on Capitol Hill in the face of a surprisingly cohesive Democratic Party. Little headway. Did you hear that?
Well, it doesn't matter what happens now. We're right on schedule, Mark. President George W. two-terms mandate Bush has got a big surprise cooked up for everyone next year. When it comes to politics, man's a master chef. He's up there with Emeril. Bam!
All right. Look. All right. Wait, listen. Try this quote, Lawton.
Yep.
Moderate Republicans on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee have forced a postponement on the Bolton vote after voicing reservations about his suitability for the post of America's top diplomat, unquote. His own party. Huh.
Right? He's just kicking this whole thing up a notch. Bam!
All right, Emeril, listen to this. Quote, Tom DeLay is being steadily deserted by his fellow Republicans as questions about his use of lobbyist funds continue to dog him. Deserted? What do you think of that?
I think you should squirt some Tabasco in there and put some fire under it. Delicious.
Hang on, buddy. Listen, chef. Here's some more. Quote, the Democrats are also hanging tough in their opposition to the appointment to the Federal Appeals Court of conservative judges Janice Brown and Priscilla Owens, both blocked during Bush's first term. Blocked. Well,
it's kicking it up to notches unknown to mankind. Happy, bam.
Come on. And according to the Washington Post, my friend, Bush's approval ratings are 47%. 47% approval ratings, Lawton. What's that sound like? A big lame-ass duck to me, Lawton. Where's his mandate? Huh?
All right. You remember the story of the ugly duckling, Mark?
Yeah.
He turned into a beautiful swine president who won the war on terror and led America straight back to Jesus.
What about the setbacks, Lawton? It's undeniable. How's Bush supposed to lead now, my friend?
The man's like Seabiscuit. You think he's down, and then, bam, up another notch.
Buddy.
We're climbing.
You're in denial. You're in denial. This guy's screw-ups are finally catching up with him, Lawton. His own party's getting fed up with this crap. You can spin as many stories as you want, but he's on his way. He's on his way out, my friend. And then you guys are going to be out of power for a long, long time. And I'll bet he doesn't have a plan, does he? Where's the plan, Lawton? What's this big surprise of his? Where's the plan, Mr. Bam? Huh? Huh? Yeah.
There's no plan.
Okay.
There's no bam. It's the opposite of bam. Mab.
What
mab.
Is it, mab?
There's no kicking it up enough.
Come on.
We're kicking it down enough.
No, take it easy.
Two notches.
All right. Yeah.
Mab. We went down another notch.
All right, buddy. Just take it easy.
Oh, Colin. He's a screw up and everybody's bailing on him.
Okay.
Mab.
Just stop saying mab. Just take it easy, all right?
No,
it's a little weird.
I'm pretty sad, though.
I know. Just pull it together, buddy. Pull it together, okay? It's okay to admit failure. Oh, man. Wow.
Better now.
Okay, yeah.
Wait till next year, Mark. Makes my mouth water. We're gonna have Bush gumbo next year.
Oh, yeah.
Bam!
No, good luck.
Delicious, good eating, my friend.
Well, goodbye, Lawton.
Good eating. God loves you. Deal with it.
Bam! Hey, you got to get that last one in, didn't he? Bam! Thank you, Lawton. You know, I'll tell you. You know, I think he's scrambling. It was nice. He was almost vulnerable using the cooking metaphors. I think we had him on the ropes there.
Well, I think you might have gotten him very close to the ropes. I don't know.
Phil Lesh's book is Searching for the Sound, My Life with the Grateful Dead. Ooh. It's sort of a memoir, sort of personal exploration. It's Phil Lesh, man. The dude wrote Box of Rain. You know what I'm saying? This is going to be good stuff. I can't wait to see him. Riley, are you a little excited?
A little excited.
Okay, buddy. So we'll be back with Phil Lesh, the bass player of the Grateful Dead, after this. It's Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. personal freedoms. It is America.
Jerry Springer on Air America Radio.
Hey, how are you? 34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Reilly.
Hey.
It's morning's edition on Air America Radio. I'm actually getting some sort of weird residual giggling here. The book is...
That's me.
I know. It's Phil Lesh. Hey, he's in the studio. He's the bass player for the Grateful Dead. Has been since the very beginning. His new book, Searching for the Sound, My Life with the Grateful Dead, I believe is actually the first book written by a member of the Grateful Dead about the Grateful Dead. Is that true?
As far as I know, yes, it is.
You look incredibly well, man.
Thank you.
Considering what you've lived through.
I feel good.
Doesn't he look great?
He does look great.
So now, the book is starting at the very beginning of your life and moving all the way through the history of the Dead.
Yes, it is.
And what was the primary thrust of writing the book for you? What did you find out about yourself as you wrote it?
Well, it's not so much that I found out anything new while I was writing it, but I did discover that my memories were extremely vivid and detailed, and so it sort of put to rest that old shibboleth about if you remember the 60s, you weren't there.
Especially if you defined them like you did, because if you have clear memories, that goes against a lot of the folklore about drugs and alcohol use.
It certainly does. And I'm proud to be able to fly in the face of folklore.
I'm happy you're here. So let me, what's going on with the Dead now? Where are you guys at? There's a lot of people that would like to know that, I think.
Well, we've been touring together fairly regularly for the last 3 years,
mm-hmm.
and we're trying to get something together. I mean, what we finally agreed upon after all the turmoil after Jerry's death was that what we're really about is playing music together.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to get together 3 years ago, 2002, and do exactly that. So we put together a weekend where everybody brought their own bands, and those bands played. And then at the end of the 2 days, we would play together. And that worked out so well. We toured, did a fall tour in 2002 and a summer tour in 2003 and 2004. And right now, we're trying to put something together for our 40th anniversary, but in typical Grateful Dead fashion, we can't quite agree on what it's going to be. Who's holding out? You?
No way. No way. I'm saying, come on, you guys. Let's do something.
Who's the prima donna of the Grateful Dead?
There is none.
Okay.
I don't want to blow you guys' images or anything, but
they're collaborative prima donnas. Well,
that's right. The whole thing is a prima donna all by itself.
You look at the pictures of you guys. I mean, over the years, over all 30 years, and you always look like you're having a good time. It doesn't look like there's any real hostility.
But no, because you know what. I was born an only child,
mm-hmm.
and these people, I discovered that these were my true brothers,
mm-hmm.
and I discovered them through a series of improbable coincidences, but there's some kind of karmic link there that just can't be denied, and no matter how frustrated we become with one another, with each other's stubbornness and unwillingness to look at reality as we see it, that fact remains. And it's Bobby likes to say that we have a tie, a bond that is thicker than blood.
You know, I have a friend who is, I guess you would call, I hate to use, you know, cliches, but he's a deadhead.
No.
Yeah, and I one of the things I never knew about the group was that you used to do a lot of different songs. Before they were released, I heard A Touch of Grey done in a completely different tempo 3 years before the album came out.
Yeah.
And talk a little bit about, you know, how did you decide how to shape that particular song and other songs that you do differently in the studio than you do live?
Well, the thing is that the studio was never an important venue for the Grateful Dead. It was pretty much a side thing. It was a throwaway. We made records because it was expected of us, and it was a way to generate, or it was supposed to be a way to generate interest in the band. What we did was we played live for people.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when we did go in the studio and we just brought in songs that we hadn't played live in front of people, they didn't come off as well.
Okay.
As working them up in the studio and then recording them. So we just sort of evolved a policy where we're gonna take these songs and we're gonna give them a face, we're gonna give them a personality, a character of their own,
in concert and in front of an audience. And the thing about the different ways of doing them is that the music really demands to be interpreted in different ways. I mean, the best thing we can do to a song is to speed it up or slow it down, or change the arrangement, or stick in an extended instrumental in the middle of it, or at the beginning or at the end, because it just enhances it. It makes it richer.
It makes it like a living organism that evolves.
My words exactly. You're reading my mind.
Well, I mean, I noticed that I've been to a few shows. I wouldn't say I had a Grateful Dead addiction, but I certainly lived with a couple of Deadheads during my college years.
Everyone?
Yeah, right. And I'd like to personally thank you in 1984 at the Worcester Centrum for playing Warfret. It really made my night. You know, of course, I was on
You're
drugs.
Very welcome. You were, you know.
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, it's like being a little bit pregnant.
I was on a lot of drugs. That was a mushroom evening, but it was Warfare worked for me. It was a good time.
That's a good song.
Now, what about it's funny because I mean having lived with Deadheads and every time that you guys did Space, I mean you do Space, you know, every show.
Hey, we are Space.
Okay. Define it for the rest of the world.
Well, in the middle of every Dead show, there will be a musical exploration. What would you call Space?
Well, I would call it us playing around without drums.
Tuning?
No, we usually take an hour to do that before we start playing.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's just this sort of a musical exploration that went on every show, and you know, a lot of times it was just weird because it was not really an intermission because you could hang out and talk and sometimes go in and out of the music. Yeah. A lot of people went to the bathroom, but it was something that you did every show, right? From the beginning.
Well, we just wanted to strip it down to nothing really, and start from silence.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah, from its essence to the whole. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. To build it up and see how it would flow, and to see what kind of ideas would come out of it. Sometimes we could go right into a song, because what we were playing would evolve into a song, not necessarily one we'd planned to do before we started.
So you didn't know.
Like occasionally, it was like that, and in fact, more often than not.
Because that's always like the big one of the big Deadhead things.
That I like.
Yeah, you know, like one of the big Deadhead things was sort of like, what are they going to go into? Where is it going to go? And a lot of times you didn't know. I'm glad. I'm happy to know that.
Well, because that's the thing that we decided early on that we were gonna do with the music. We were never gonna play the same show twice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of bands, they'll make a record, they'll tour behind the record, and it's really record driven.
Yeah.
And they'll tour behind the record and they'll play the record and they'll play some of their old hits, you know, and they'll do that same show every night.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably
yeah.
in the same sequence. Since recording wasn't our driving factor or our driving force, playing for people was, and specifically playing for dancers. Because that's where we evolved in the dance halls of San Francisco.
San Francisco.
Yeah. So we just early on fell into that pattern of just of playing as long as we've got enough material to play Tuesday,
keep going
a different show every night. Yeah, that's what.
Well, it's funny because Miles Davis had, I think, kind of the same philosophy. He never really wanted to play the same thing over and over and over.
Oh no, and if you listen to his recordings of stuff if you listen to the stuff that he recorded in the studio, and then let's take Milestones for instance.
Yeah.
There's the studio version, which is at a certain tempo, and then there's the Plug Nickel,
yeah.
the Plug Nickel CDs from, I guess that's Washington, D.C. Club?
Or, I believe it was.
Okay,
D.C.
yeah. And, I mean, the tempo on that one is, like, blisteringly fast. I mean, like, almost twice as fast as the one on the Columbia record.
Yeah.
So, of course, Miles is the total paradigm as the band leader, and it's bringing the best out of his players and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. But now I got to ask you this, because the Grateful Dead is one of two bands I know that routinely use two drummers. James Brown used two drummers on a lot of occasions as well.
Yeah, no.
How difficult was it to do that and maintain the integrity of the song, number one? And did it lead you on any interesting rhythmic exploration?
Well, see, that was the whole thing. What we discovered was that when Mickey joined the band, we could get these kind of infinity rhythm grooves where you had the two drummers and they weren't playing the same thing.
Yeah.
They were interlocking or playing interlocking patterns. Maybe there'd be a common backbeat or a couple of common bass drum, kick drum beats, but everything else was interlocked. And so that freed up the other musicians in the band to play with any part of both of them.
Really? So, and you as a bass player, you could do that. You could drum on it.
Well, I started doing that when we only had one drummer.
Yeah. Have you seen his bass? What, is this an Alembic? What kind of bass is it?
That's actually a modular six-string now.
Really? Oh,
I've been using them for about 20 years.
Beautiful, man. But the thing about the drummer thing is, like, it seems like Bill could sort of, he's like a swinger, you know? And Mickey was, like, out there, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he was always into a lot of world music, played with a lot of different ensembles around the world.
Yeah, he had his mind twisted by tabla drumming, Indian tabla drumming. And
so did Jay-Z.
That's cool.
How can it not twist your mind? The rhythm's a whole different thing.
Yeah, it's just a whole different world. And, of course, the melodic aspect of that music is also fascinating. And that was a big influence on us as well, because they don't play chords.
Okay.
They play a modal music that is over a drone. Which is very similar to what a lot of the stuff that Coltrane used to do with the Great Quartet.
Yes.
So we sort of stole those ideas and planted them in rock and roll.
How many shows? Do you have any idea how many shows you played in your life?
I think the number has grown to about 2,500, just the Grateful Dead.
Wow. So we're talking to Phil Lesh. The book is Searching for the Sound: My Life with the Grateful Dead. And I have a writer here on our staff who the other night we were talking about you coming on. And he had this moment where he didn't know whether it was cool for him to be proud to be a Deadhead. Like, he was like, you know,
oh, this poor guy.
Well, he's coming in here after this.
Do we have an identity crisis here?
Yeah.
He's going to come in and say hi after this. Okay. We'll be back with Phil Lesh in a second at the 45 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Edition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
1-800-801-GAME. That's 1-800-801-GAME. Call now. 1-800-801-GAME.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program.
Yo!
We're talking to Phil Lesh. The book is Searching for the Sound, My Life with the Grateful Dead. We are sitting here with one of the icons of the 60s. I'm thrilled, man. When I was growing up, I'm just thrilled you're here. All my heroes were of your generation. The Grateful Dead was a big favorite of mine. Now, here's a question I'm curious about, and somebody actually called in with, is that, as you said, recorded music was never your bag, though, you know, many of your records are great, like that one we were just playing, I Love, still brings tears to my eyes, actually. But you actually encourage people to tape your shows. You let them use high-tech audio equipment. You go to any Dead show, there would be the little fenced-in area with the
forest of microphones.
Yeah, and you were actually encouraging the first file sharing. So obviously, you don't have a problem with people, you know, reproducing your music.
Absolutely not. Jerry put it so beautifully early on when we had a discussion about that. Okay, this is starting to happen.
Yeah.
What are we going to do about it? And Jerry said, when we've played it, we're finished with it. Let them have it.
Oh, Jerry.
And that's so in the spirit of the Grateful Dead.
Well, really, it's certainly in the spirit of what you were talking about before, making every show different. Every song is an evolving sort of organism. And I think that had a lot to do with 60s creativity in general, the whole, you know, Ken Kesey pushing it further, kind of getting out there, improv. You knew him, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We used to, when we were, before the band started, and I was just a college student, we used to party next door. One of his friends, a psychiatrist, a grad student named Vic Lavelle, whom I just met at a book signing again after 40 years. He used to let people come in and hang in his house. He had a neat living room with a fireplace and a peaked ceiling and mattresses and stuff like that. And all the younger people would come and hang there on weekend nights. And we'd get kind of rowdy sometime, and Kesey would come over and kick us out.
Really?
Who is this guy? And, you know, but the word started getting around. This guy's a really amazing, talented writer.
So when did he eventually, because he went the other direction. I can't picture Kesey kicking anyone out of anywhere.
He had his little quirks, like everybody. But he published his first book, Cuckoo's Nest, and, of course, everybody was just knocked out by it.
Yeah.
Just blown away. It was such a fine book. And his voice, you know, his voice, it was such a powerful thing. But then at that same time, he was that the book was coming out. He was being administered LSD by the Veterans Administration or some kind of program that was secretly funded by the CIA.
Sure.
Now Robert Hunter, our lyricist, was also part of that program at the same time. So he got into LSD before anybody.
And the military issue LSD.
Yeah.
Mind control, can you imagine that?
Well, right.
I guess if it weren't for the CIA, we wouldn't have had the 60s on some level.
you could say that. Although my feeling is that it would have happened anyway.
This is Bruce Cherry. This is Phil Lesh, one of his big fans.
Hey!
Bruce Cherry, who I'm sure, he's holding a solo album you did, Phil. When was the last time you saw that?
That's a long time. As a matter of fact, I saw a copy at a book signing in San Francisco just a little while ago.
Did the guy look exactly like Bruce?
I sell it to you for $200.
Well, I actually have a CD, but I haven't seen the vinyl.
Yeah, I told Mark, man, you probably have a box of records in the garage somewhere.
Actually, no, I don't, but I know somebody who does.
So, Bruce,
really, you guys, you don't keep the things? You don't have, like, a Warlock CD, the first single, Scorpio, or whatever it was?
Yeah, there might be something like that in the vault, although the actual vinyl is stuff that generally didn't get saved. We just keep the master tapes.
So, Phil, is there an actual vault?
Yeah, there is.
Really?
There is a vault.
Where is it?
None of your business. Why do you think we call it the vault?
Somewhere in the Bay Area bunker, there's the Grateful Dead vault.
Exactly.
That's hilarious.
It's right below Dick Cheney's vault.
Oh, way below. Phil is going to be in Madison, Connecticut tonight at RJ Julia, and he's going to be at Bookends in Ridgewood, New Jersey tomorrow night. What's the turnout like of these book signings?
It's been really wonderful. The thing about the book signings and also about blood drives that I've done in the past is I get to see the people who come to our shows close up instead of having them be little figures that are very far away. And you can't even recognize their features except for maybe the first two rows.
How many of them look like Bruce?
A lot.
I'm a caricature.
Yeah, I'm going to paint a picture for our audience. Long, sort of wavy, gray hair, a little portly. Sort of,
Portly is, yeah, that's a nice way to...
Unlike Phil, who is lean.
And mean.
Yes. Phil, you know, I swear, it's really a pleasure meeting you, and I hope people enjoy the book. It's Phil Lesh, Searching for the Sound, My Life with the Grateful Dead. What are the plans for touring in the future with the band?
As I said earlier, we can't quite agree.
Yeah, right.
Exactly what it is we want to do. We want to do something because it's been 40 years.
Are you going out as the Dead?
We don't know.
Okay.
I know that I'm bringing my band, Phil Lesh and Friends, to... everywhere I can find to play in November around Thanksgiving.
All right, well, thanks for being with us, Phil.
My pleasure.
Really great
thanks,
to see
Phil.
You. That's the sound of the fax machine with the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Write these down here, your marching orders for today. One, protest the maiden flight of the world's largest passenger plane, the Airbus A380, by pretending to forget your frequent flyer number when requesting the ovo-lacto vegetarian meal. Two, to alleviate your pet's trauma after getting spayed, give yourself a sympathy vasectomy. Three, now that the Ethics Committee is free to go after Tom DeLay, adjust the congressional probe setting to maximum penetration. Four, it's Take Your Daughter to Work Day. Introduce her to today's modern workplace by beating her head against the glass ceiling and having an executive grab her ass while you do it. Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Quote, so George Bush retreated to his underground bunker yesterday. Wake up, sheeple. He's marrying Eva Braun, and we're all invited to the wedding.
Oh, my
That's
God.
It. Again, Phil, great meeting you. Thank you.
Thanks
great
a lot,
being
man.
On the show, man. Thank
now,
you.
We got somebody tomorrow, some guy named Seth, somebody.
Oh, yes.
I don't know.
Yes,
we've
got Seth MacFarlane, creator of The Family Guy, and Mick Ware.
Oh, Mick Ware. Now, him I know.
Yes. And, again, great show, Riley.
Great show today. Great having Phil in here. Great even having Bruce in here.
Bruce Cherry.
We'll see you tomorrow, folks. This is Air America Radio.